Chapter 56. After this her daily tasks were gone through heavily enough, and brought on the day which was of great import to agriculturists, the day of the Candlemas Fair. It was at this fair that new engagements were entered into for the 12 months following the ensuing Lady Day, and those of the farming population who thought of changing their places duly attended at the county town, where the fair was held. Nearly all the laborers on Flintcomb Ash Farm intended flight, and early in the morning there was a general exodus in the direction of the town, which lay at a distance of from 10 to 12 miles over hilly country. Though Tess also meant to leave at the quarter day, she was one of the few who did not go to the fair, having a vaguely shaped hope that something would happen to render another outdoor engagement unnecessary. It was a peaceful February day, of wonderful softness for the time, and one would almost have thought that winter was over. Essie had hardly finished her dinner, when D'Urberville's figure darkened the window of the cottage wherein she was a lodger, which Essie had all to herself today. Tess jumped up, but her visitor had knocked at the door, and she could hardly in reason run away. D'Urberville's knock, his walk up to the door, had some indescribable quality of difference from his air when she last saw him. They seemed to be acts of which the doer was ashamed. She thought that she would not open the door, but, as there was no sense in that either, she arose, and having lifted the latch stepped back quickly. He came in, saw her, and flung himself down into a chair before speaking. "Tess, I couldn't help it," he began desperately, as he wiped his heated face, which had also a superimposed flush of excitement. I felt that I must call at least to ask how you are. I assure you I had not been thinking of you at all till I saw you that Sunday. Now I cannot get rid of your image, try how I may. It is hard that a good woman should do harm to a bad man, yet so it is. If you would only pray for me, Tess." The suppressed discontent of his manner was almost pitiable, and yet Tess did not pity him. "How can I pray for you," she said, "when I am forbidden to believe that the great power who moves the world would alter his plans on my account?" "You really think that?" "Yes. I have been cured of the presumption of thinking otherwise."
"Cured? By whom?"
"By my husband, if I must tell."
"I, your husband, your husband? How strange it seems. I remember you hinted something of the sort the other day. What do you really believe in these matters, Tess?" he asked. "You seem to have no religion, perhaps owing to me.
But I have. Though I don't believe in anything supernatural." D'Urberville looked at her with misgiving.
"Then do you think that the line I take is all wrong?"
"A good deal of it. And yet I felt so sure about it," he said uneasily. "I believe in the spirit of the Sermon on the Mount, and so did my dear husband. But I don't believe," here she gave her negations. "The fact is," said D'Urberville dryly, "whatever your dear husband believed you accept, and whatever he rejected you reject, without the least inquiry or reasoning on your own part. That's just like you women. Your mind is enslaved to his."
"Ah, because he knew everything,"
said she, with a triumphant simplicity of faith in Angel Clare that the most perfect man could hardly have deserved, much less her husband.
"Yes, but you should not take negative opinions wholesale from another person like that. A pretty fellow he must be, to teach you such skepticism."
"He never forced my judgment. He would never argue on the subject with me. But I looked at it in this way. What he believed, after inquiring deep into doctrines, was much more likely to be right than what I might believe, who hadn't looked into doctrines at all.
What used he to say?"
"He must have said something," she reflected, and with her acute memory for the letter of Angel Clare's remarks, even when she did not comprehend their spirit, she recalled a merciless polemical syllogism that S.E. had heard him use when, as it occasionally happened, he indulged in a species of thinking aloud with her at his side. In delivering it, she gave also Clare's accent and manner with reverential faithfulness.
"Say that again," asked D'Urberville, who had listened with the greatest attention. She repeated the argument, and D'Urberville thoughtfully murmured the words after her. "Anything else?" he presently asked. He said at another time something like this, and she gave another, which might possibly have been paralleled in many a work of the pedigree ranging from the Dictionnaire Philosophique to Huxley's essays. "Aha! How do you remember them?" I wanted to believe what he believed, though he didn't wish me to, and I managed to coax him to tell me a few of his thoughts. "I can't say I quite understand that one, but I know it is right. H'M. Fancy your being able to teach me what you don't know yourself." He fell into thought. "And so I threw in my spiritual lot with his," she resumed. "Didn't wish it to be different. What's good enough for him is good enough for me. Does he know that you are as big an infidel as he?" "No, I never told him, if I am an infidel." "Well, you are better off today than I am, Tess, after all. You don't believe that you ought to preach my doctrine, and, therefore, do no despite to your conscience in abstaining." "I do believe I ought to preach it, but like the devils I believe and tremble, for I suddenly leave off preaching it, and give way to my passion for you." "How?" "Why," he said airedly, "I have come all the way here to see you today. But I started from home, to go to Casterbridge Fair, where I have undertaken to preach the word from a wagon at 2:30 this afternoon, and where all the brethren are expecting me this minute. Here's the announcement." He drew from his breast pocket a poster whereon was printed the day, hour, and place of meeting, at which he, D'Urberville, would preach the gospel as aforesaid. "But how can you get there?" said Tess, looking at the clock. "I cannot get there. I have come here." "What, you have really arranged to preach, and I have arranged to preach, and I shall not be there by reason of my burning desire to see a woman whom I once despised?" "No, by my word and truth, I never despised you. If I had, I should not love you now. Why I did not despise you was on account of your being unsmirched in spite of all. You withdrew yourself from me so quickly and resolutely, when you saw the situation. You did not remain at my pleasure, so there was one petticoat in the world for whom I had no contempt, and you are she. But you may well despise me now. I thought I worshipped on the mountains, but I find I still serve in the groves. Ha! Ha! Oh, Alec D'Urberville! What does this mean? What have I done?" "Done?" he said, with a soulless sneer in the word. "Nothing intentionally. But you have been the means, the innocent means of my backsliding, as they call it. I ask myself, am I, indeed, one of those servants of corruption who, after they have escaped the pollutions of the world, are again entangled there, and overcome whose latter end is worse than their beginning?" He laid his hand on her shoulder. "Tess, my girl, I was on the way to, at least, social salvation till I saw you again," he said, freakishly shaking her, as if she were a child. "And why then have you tempted me? I was firm as a man could be till I saw those eyes, and that mouth again. Surely there never was such a maddening mouth since Eve's." His voice sank, and a hot archness shot from his own black eyes. "Ooh, temptress, Tess. You dear damned witch of Babylon, I could not resist you, as soon as I met you again. I couldn't help your seeing me again," said Tess, recoiling. "I know it, I repeat that I do not blame you. But the fact remains. When I saw you ill-used on the farm, that day I was nearly mad to think that I had no legal right to protect you, that I could not have it, whilst he who has it seemed to neglect you utterly. Don't speak against him, he is absent," she cried in much excitement. "Read him honorably, he has never wronged you. Oh, leave his wife before any scandal spreads that may do harm to his honest name." I will, he said, like a man awakening from a luring dream. "Have broken my engagement to preach to those poor drunken boobies at the fair. It is the first time I have played such a practical joke. A month ago I should have been horrified at such a possibility. I'll go away to swear and can I, to keep away." Then, suddenly: colon one clasp, Tessie one. Only for old friendship, I am without defense. Alec, a good man's honor is in my keeping, think me ashamed.
Pooh. Well, yes, yes.
He clenched his lips, mortified with himself for his weakness. His eyes were equally barren of worldly and religious faith. The corpses of those old fitful passions which had lain inanimate amid the lines of his face ever since his reformation seemed to wake and come together as in a resurrection. He went out indeterminately. Though D'Urberville had declared that this breach of his engagement today was the simple backsliding of a believer, Tess's words, as echoed from Angel Clare, had made a deep impression upon him, and continued to do so, after he had left her. He moved on in silence, as if his energies were benumbed by the hitherto undreamt of possibility that his position was untenable. Reason had had nothing to do with his whimsical conversion, which was perhaps the mere freak of a careless man in search of a new sensation, and temporarily impressed by his mother's death. The drops of logic Tess had let fall into the sea of his enthusiasm served to chill its effervescence to stagnation. He said to himself, as he pondered again and again over the crystallized phrases that S. he had handed on to him, that clever fellow little thought that, by telling her those things, he might be paving my way back to her. XLVII, it is the threshing of the last wheat rick at Flintcomb Ash Farm. The dawn of the March morning is singularly inexpressive, and there is nothing to show where the eastern horizon lies. Against the twilight, rises the trapezoidal top of the stack, which has stood forlornly here through the washing and bleaching of the wintry weather. When Ishewood and Tess arrived at the scene of operations, only a rustling denoted that others had preceded them, to which, as the light increased, there were presently added the silhouettes of two men on the summit. They were busily nailing the rick, that is, stripping off the thatch, before beginning to throw down the sheaves, and while this was in progress, Iz and Tess, with the other women workers, in their whitey-brown pinners, stood waiting and shivering, Farmer Groby having insisted upon their being on the spot thus early to get the job over, if possible by the end of the day. Close under the eaves of the stack, and as yet barely visible, was the red tyrant that the women had come to serve, a timber-framed construction, with straps and wheels appertaining the threshing machine which, whilst it was going, kept up a despotic demand upon the endurance of their muscles and nerves. A little way off there was another indistinct figure, this one black, with a sustained hiss that spoke of strength very much in reserve. The long chimney running up beside an ash tree, and the warmth which radiated from the spot, explained without the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.